Okay, well, good evening, everybody. Can I be heard loud and clear everywhere?
No, only here.
Only here. Not outside, though. Okay. All right, I have to tell you, this is my first usage of PowerPoint. I was inspired to use it by Vladimir Krauss, who gave such a presentation very recently that I was impressed with. And so I'm trying my hand at PowerPoint. Now, in the space of less than an hour, I'm going to try to give you an overview of my theory of profit and interest and some of its major applications. I view profit and interest as so closely connected that I'll often refer to them in my talk as profit slash interest. One reason for this closeness of connection is that historically the words profit and interest have been used by different authors to describe essentially the same phenomenon, namely the difference between the value of products produced and the sum of the values of the means of production used up in producing them, i.e. their costs of production. The classical economists call this difference profit. Members of the Austrian school usually refer to it as originary interest. Almost all other economists proceed as though most of what businessmen and accountants regard as profit is in fact interest, even if they do not use the expression originary interest. Both the classical economists and the Austrian economists regard the rate of interest on loans, or loan interest, as being determined by the rate of profit or originary interest, and treat it as part of profit or originary interest. So I'm not going to be making any special reference to loan interest. I'm always going to be talking about profit and originary interest. I too hold this view and follow this practice. And it's for these reasons that I refer to profit slash interest. Now, the best place to begin, I think, is with a brief description and critique of the two current mainstream theories of profit interest, namely the conventional time preference theory and the productivity theory. The reason I say conventional time preference theory is because my own very different theory is also a time preference theory. Learning what's fundamentally wrong with these two theories, the conventional time preference and productivity theories, learning what's wrong with them will be the starting point for seeing what we need to do differently in order to get on the right track toward explaining profit interest. Incidentally, I hope you'll forgive me if sometimes I have nothing to say beyond repeating the content of the slide. That's what happens when a slide says it all. And in such cases, hopefully my intonation will add something. All right, let's start with the conventional time preference theory. What it claims is, the way it attempts to explain profit interest is as follows. It begins with the proposition future goods not to be available until some point in the future, are worth less than present goods of the same kind and quantity. Thus, for example, 10 apples to be available 1 year from now are worth less than 10 apples available now. They're equal in value, say, to 9 apples available now. That's the basic idea. We subjectively value goods in the present above goods in the future, or goods in the nearer future above goods in the more remote future. So we value the 9 apples available today as highly as 10 apples available a year from now. Well, means of production are valued as future goods. Their value derives from the value of their products, but those products will not be available until the future. accordingly, the totality of the means of producing 10 apples to be available 1 year from now is valued as 10 future apples, and thus has a value of only 9 present apples. So the means of producing 10 apples to be available a year from today are valued in the present as 9 present apples. All right, the year passes, and when it does, means of production initially worth 9 present apples are physically transformed into the 10 apples. After all, we started with means of production sufficient to produce 10 apples available in a year. We valued those means of production as 9 present apples. Now the year has passed. These means of production have matured into 10 apples. And those 10 apples are now present apples. Profit interest, according to the conventional time preference theory, is explained by the growth of 9 present apples into 10 present apples. Sometimes the idea is expressed by saying that means of production are purchased at a discount to the future value of their products, and that when the future arrives and becomes the present, the discount is shaken off. At that time, the means of production have become the product, and more lowly valued means of production have become more highly valued present goods. I think this should accord with any exposition of the time preference theory you've heard earlier this week. I'm sure it must be the same. All right, well, let's turn skipped a slide.
Back arrow? Just go up to previous.
Yeah.
Previous, yeah. Okay.
Is that we
want? No, that's advancing me.
Well, you got to, yeah. Each time you want to go to previous, you have to go up and edit one at a time.
I'm sorry?
You can fix it so that you don't have to, but.
What do I have to do?
You press the left arrow on the page.
There you go.
Okay, good. Thank you very much. I'm glad I began by telling you it's my first time with PowerPoint. All right, so now let's turn to the productivity theory. It attempts to explain profit interest in this way, and here I use the very same example that Bombavric related in Capital and Interest. A primitive fisherman gathers 3 fish per day with his bare hands. If he reduced his consumption to 2 fish per day for 100 days and saved 1 fish per day during this time, he would accumulate a stock of 100 fish. 100 fish would be sufficient to support his labor for 50 days, in which time he could construct a boat and net. With the boat and net, he could catch 30 fish per day instead of only 3 fish per day, i.e. 27 extra fish per day. If the boat and net last for 100 days, the fisherman is enabled to produce an extra 2,700 fish. He gains 2,700 extra fish at the price of the temporary sacrifice of 150 fish, the fish he could have gathered if he had not constructed the boat and net, i.e. a profit of 2,550 fish. In case you're wondering how a primitive fisherman could preserve fish over a span of 150 days, the example can be modified to avoid this problem by supposing the fisherman contents himself with catching just 2 fish per day for 150 days while devoting a third of his labor each day to constructing the boat and net. But this, of course, is an unimportant detail. The essential idea is 2,700 extra fish are gained at the expense of the temporary sacrifice of 150 fish, and that the net physical gain of 2,550 fish is supposedly a basis for explaining profit interest. Paul Samuelson says of exactly this kind of example. This quotation follows a discussion of fish and boats and nets. He says, in the most general sense, this yield, more future consumption in return for foregone present consumption, is the return on capital. He is saying the future extra consumption of 2,700 fish, 2,700 more fish in the future at the temporary foregoing of 150 fish in the present, that explains the return on capital. And this passage appears in one of the editions of his textbook, may still be appearing in the latest. And his textbook over the last 55 years or so has, for most of that time, been the world's leading economics textbook. Now, I refer to the common denominator of the time preference and productivity theories. These two theories, the time preference and productivity theory, are often viewed as mutually exclusive alternatives. And I'm sure you'll find here, among the Austrian economists, where the time preference theory is supported, I would expect almost everyone to flatly reject the productivity theory. And at many other places, you'd find the opposite being the case. Nevertheless, there is a major common element, this common denominator, that these two theories share, a common element that the time preference and productivity theory share. Namely, both of them view profit interest, which is an excess of money received over money expended. They both view this monetary excess as explainable on the basis of a physical surplus of consumers' goods. For example, a net gain of one present apple or a net gain of 2,550 fish. This gain in terms of physical products, a present apple, 2,550 fish, this physical increase is somehow supposed to explain a monetary surplus. And let us keep in mind that when we are talking of profit and interest as normal people understand it, we are talking of the earning of sales revenues, money sales revenues, in excess of money costs. And any theory of profit interest must explain that. If it can't do that, it's got an insuperable problem. Well, now, it's very, very important to realize right here at the outset, in order for either of these explanations to hold up, it must be assumed that the monetary value of a present apple will be the same next year as it is this year, and that the monetary value of a fish will be the same, even though, in this illustration, 10 times as many fish are being produced. Now just think, if we start with 9 present apples and end with 10 present apples, that will only explain a dollar of profit if each apple is worth a dollar now and a year from now. Well, then we have 9 present apples worth $9, and then we'll have 10 present apples worth $10, and okay, we've explained a dollar of profit. But what if there's a change in the monetary value of a present apple? Suppose this year a present apple is worth a dollar, but next year when we've got 10 present apples, maybe a present apple is only worth 90 cents. Well, then our 10 present apples would have no greater monetary value than did the 9 that we started out with, and we'd have no profit. We have to assume, therefore, that the monetary value of the present apple is going to be the same next year as this year. And certainly we have to assume the same thing with respect to the fish. If a surplus of 2,550 fish is to translate into a monetary surplus, the monetary value of a fish better be the same at both points in time. And now I refer, I say, in order for this to be possible, in order for the monetary value of the present apple or the fish or whatever, in order for these prices to be unchanged, there must be an unstated assumption made by these two mainstream theories, and that assumption is that the quantity of money and volume of spending in the economic system somehow automatically grows to keep pace with any increase in the overall supply of consumers' goods over time, so that their prices can be assumed to be unchanged. We have to assume that if we're going to have any more present apples next year than this year, any more fish next year than this year, if the price of a present apple or a fish or whatever is in fact going to be the same and there's more of them in the future, well, there's going to have to be more money and spending in the future to make that possible. It's only on that assumption that their prices can be assumed to be unchanged. Now, I say that there's a breakdown of the mainstream theories. Both mainstream theories break down over this point. It's the reef on which they shatter, in my judgment. Specifically, the formulas of both mainstream theories break down as explanations of profit interest in terms of money if the assumption is made that the quantity of money and overall volume of spending in the economic system is unchanged. If we assume an economy which has an unchanged quantity of money from one year to the next, and it's supporting an unchanged total volume of spending. See, if we accept the quantity theory of money, the quantity theory of money holds, essentially, that the amount of money that is spent in a year is determined by the quantity of money that exists. And we're assuming that that is true. And if the quantity of money at the start of this year is going to continue to be the same, it'll be the same next year, well, then we should expect that the total spending in the economy next year is going to be the same as the total spending this year. And let's see where that leads us. In that case, if there is no increase in money and spending in the economic system, in that case, I say 10 times the fish, and I ask you to read 10 times the supply of consumers' goods in general. In the face of an unchanged volume of spending, that would result in prices being reduced to a tenth of their initial level, and thus in no additional monetary profit or interest whatever coming into existence. Now, the reason I substitute consumers' goods in general for fish, because if one talked seriously about the effect of a major increase in the supply of something like fish, the odds are that the sales revenues of that industry would plunge because the demand for such a good is highly inelastic. The result of a plunge in sales revenues would be a plunge in the profitability of that industry. The industry would produce more. It might produce 10 times as many fish, but earn less. Just imagine, suppose we have 10 times as many fish, and the effect is the price of a fish falls below a tenth. That could certainly happen if you have a highly inelastic demand. In that case, the fish industry takes in less money in the face of its vastly greater production, and it would probably be running at losses. But at least when we talk of the supply of consumers' goods in general, not something like fish, when we talk of the supply of consumers' goods in general, we can assume what economists call a demand curve of unit elasticity. That is one in which the change in prices is in inverse proportion to the change in quantity supplied. And that would follow if we do assume that there is an unchanged quantity of money and an unchanged total volume of spending for consumers' goods. Imagine we assume there's an economy where each year, year in and year out, $10 trillion are being spent to buy the totality of consumers' goods, and that's it. Well, what would be implied if over some period of years the total physical quantity of consumers' goods were to double? But it's still going to have to be purchased for $10 trillion. Well, what does it take for $10 trillion to buy twice as much? It takes a halving of the price. So whenever you assume the total spending the same, you have the situation for prices falling in inverse proportion to the increase in supply. Now, here we are. We could have the fishing industry or the whole economy in general. It's 10 times as productive because it's adopted these more roundabout methods of production. We're producing 10 units where we used to produce only three or only one, whatever. We're producing vastly more. It would be in the ratio of 10 to 1. We're producing 30 fish a day instead of 3, 30 units of consumers' goods instead of 3, a 10 to 1 increase. Well, in the face of the same total spending, that implies a reduction in prices to a tenth, and the monetary value of the 10 times output would be unchanged, and we wouldn't have any basis for any greater profits than we did to start with. And the same point about a fall in price applies to the time preference theory also. The formula of the time preference theory implies that if means of production worth 9 units of present goods could produce 20 units of future goods to be available in a year, the rate of profit interest should be as 11 to 9. Just think, we have means of production worth 9 present apples, and we're going to produce 20 future apples. Well, what happens when the future arrives? How many present apples are those 20 future apples? Well, they're then 20 present apples, right? So we've gone from 9 present apples to 20 present apples. How much of a gain have we had in terms of present apples? We've had a gain of 11 present apples. Well, our rate of profit interest should presumably be 11 of profit over 9 of initial outlay. We should have 122% rate of return here. But what if the substitution of 20 future apples for 10 is the result of our production doubling over this period? We have double the supply of output a year from now. If there's no more money in the economy, what's implied about the prices of the goods a year from now?
They'll be lower.
They'll be cut in half. Well, now, if we have 20 future apples when the future arrives, selling at half the price of a present apple today, have we made any more profit by virtue of having had a higher ratio of future goods equal to present goods? No, the rate of profit is not moving. The formula has broken down. The formula relies on assuming an unchanged monetary value of a present good. But in order for that assumption to be able to be borne out, we would need to have an increase in the quantity of money and volume of spending in the economy sufficient to maintain the prices. Yes?
I'm confused just for a moment. Is it only apples that the price has been cut in half?
No, we're looking at this in terms of goods in general.
Well, then, aren't my 20 apples now worth twice as much as my 9 apples were before?
No, as a matter of fact, if we deal with an isolated good, it's very possible that the 20 apples would be worth less than the 10.
Right, but that was my first question.
Yeah.
Was it only the apples that were affected? And you said, no, it was the entire economy.
But it is the entire economy. And in the you see, if we took just one good, then the results would be even worse if that good has an inelastic demand. Because let's say people already have pretty much all the apples they want, and the price falls in greater proportion than the supply increases, then you'd have the same problem as with the fish. So we really have to interpret these theories in terms of a generality of future goods versus present goods, a generality of the supply of consumers' goods in the future versus the present. But when we do that, it doesn't really help because the prices fall, wiping out whatever additional profit you're expecting to exist as the result of the larger physical supplies. Well, what we need to realize, I have titled this Making the Role of Money Explicit. The role of an increase in the quantity of money in the determination of the money rate, the so-called nominal rate of profit and interest, needs to be made explicit. Both the time preference and the productivity theories implicitly take for granted an increase in the quantity of money and volume of spending commensurate with increases in the supply of consumers' goods. 2 or 10 times the goods will bring in 2 or 10 times the money, but only if there is 2 or 10 times the amount of money spent to buy goods in the economic system. See, it's true if we would have 20 future units resulting a year from today, those 20 units would sell for twice as much as 10 units do today, but in order for twice the output to sell for twice the money, there has to be twice the money in spending. If there's the same money in spending, the doubled output moves at half the price. If when we have 20 times the supply of goods, like in the fish case, well, 20 times the supply of consumers' goods will bring in 20 times the money, if and only if there's 20 times the money in spending in the economic system. If we have the same money in spending, no more money revenue comes in, and the increase in physical supply is irrelevant.
Can I assume the same inelasticity of the market?
Well, you see, on an aggregate basis, when we deal with the economy as a whole, if we make the assumption that the volume of spending is being governed essentially by the quantity of money, the aggregate consumer demand curve should neither be elastic nor inelastic. It should have unit elasticity. It's the same spending, and we'll have the same spending irrespective of the overall supply. The greater the supply, the lower the price level in inverse proportion. When we deal with isolated individual goods, sometimes a bigger supply will bring in less money, sometimes it'll bring in more money, but let's even say we have a case where a greater supply brings in more money. Like we could revise the fish example. Suppose only one fisherman adopted the more productive method. Well, that one fisherman would do spectacularly well. But still, there's an increase in the overall total supply of fish, and what's going to be the effect on the price of fish? It's going to go down, and what's the effect of that on the revenues and profits of all of the other fishermen? They go down, so we haven't shown anything about the economy-wide average. What we're out to show is how do we have a monetary surplus in the economy as a whole? How do we have a positive economy-wide average rate of profit interest? And we need to realize that these theories are implicitly taking for granted an increase in the quantity of money and volume of spending. And if that increase in the quantity of money and volume of spending is not present, if we deny that implicit assumption, their formulas break down. They collapse. They implicitly take for granted more money in spending. Now, I note here further, while they take for granted an increase in money in spending commensurate with increases in the supply of consumers' goods, they do not explicitly credit an increase in the quantity of money and volume of spending. They don't credit it with any actual role in determining the rate of profit interest in terms of money. They depend on it implicitly, but they never mention it. They take no notice. They take it for granted, ignore it, and simply credit time preference or productivity, their preferred explanations, as though it were they and not the increase in the quantity of money and volume of spending that was essential to the money rate of return. See, the point I'm making here is if we want to explain a monetary rate of profit, if we want to explain what makes it possible to spend $100 and bring in $110, if that's the kind of thing we want to explain, well, one thing that would help to explain it is more money coming in when you're selling than there was when you were buying. But the role of money is ignored. And what we want to do is we need to recognize explicitly the role of an increase in the quantity of money and volume of spending. We need to recognize this role of more money in spending in order to have a valid explanation of the money rate of profit and interest. We have to recognize that the increase in the quantity of money and volume of spending is the actual cause of a substantial portion of profit interest in terms of money. We have to admit that if what we're out to explain is how is it possible to start the year laying out certain sums of money and then regularly and consistently over the course of the year you end up bringing in more money than you laid out, we have to admit that one part of the explanation, by no means the totality, but a part is, and this is implied by the conventional time preference and productivity theories, a key part is the sheer increase in money and spending. Now, until now, there has been a limited recognition of the role of additional money in the rate of profit, but its influence has been acknowledged only in periods of inflation, when its effect has been recognized as overstating profits. People realize that when there's inflation, the inflation boosts profits, and this creates problems. As I pointed out, I think, the other day, it also boosts replacement costs. You get taxed on the additional profits. That creates serious problems. But what we have to realize is that the increase in the quantity of money and volume of spending, this monetary component, is present almost always on some scale, not just in inflation, but always. It would be present to some degree even under the purest gold standard. There is a monetary component in the rate of profit interest under the purest gold standard. And I say recognizing this fact, recognizing the existence of a monetary component, meaning an element caused by simply the increase in the quantity of money and volume of spending, recognizing that is the starting point of my own theory of profit and interest. And I want to briefly touch on this monetary component under a gold standard. And incidentally, we should realize this is not inflation, and curiously, this relates very well to Rothbard's definition of inflation. See, he differs a little bit from Mises on this. Mises regards inflation as existing in some measure. He thinks of it as an imprecise term. He thinks there's always some inflation anytime the increase in the quantity of money occurs. Rothbard starts inflation when the quantity of money surpasses the increase in specie. He measures inflation as beginning only with an increase in money in excess of specie. And that's helpful here. When there is an increase in gold under the purest gold standard, there is some increase in the quantity of money, and it does add something to the money rate of profit. Now, how? Well, the reason that we have this under a gold standard, the 1, 2, or 3% annual increase in the quantity of money that would occur under a gold standard would operate to raise sales revenues over time and thus to systematically widen the spread between sales revenues and the earlier expenditures that show up as costs, thereby adding to the rate of profit interest. Just think, a profit in money is the difference between the sales you take in and the previous expenditures you've made in past months, past years, to bring in those sales revenues. Well, think of the implication of the quantity of money and volume of spending growing, even 1, 2, or 3% a year, over the interval of time between when you've made your outlays and when you make your sales. Suppose you constructed a factory in 1970. Back in 1970, the quantity of money was a lot less than it is today. So to the extent that the expenditures made in 1970 are showing up today as part of your costs in depreciation, well, what is the effect of the intervening increase in money and spending over the last 35 years? What effect do you think that has on the sales revenues you're able to take in today to be paired with the outlay of money you made in 1970 to construct your factory? Doesn't it stand to reason that there are going to be considerably more sales revenues corresponding to every prior dollar of outlay in the past insofar as money and spending are increasing over time, and that this is present even under a gold standard? Well, even under a gold standard, this increase in the supply of gold and spending in gold is operating systematically to widen the spread between the sales revenues and the prior outlays of money that are now showing up as costs and are deducted from the sales revenues. And very importantly to note, this addition to the rate of profit interest under a gold standard would exist alongside falling prices to the extent that the increase in the production and supply of ordinary goods took place more rapidly than the increase in the quantity of money and volume of spending. Imagine here we are, we're under a gold standard, and the scientists, inventors, the savers, investors, they're making it possible for the annual production and supply of goods coming on the market to increase 3% a year. The increase in the supply of gold and spending in gold is more modest. It's growing 2% a year. Well, what's implied if we have money and spending 2% higher each year and it's buying 3% more goods each year? Doesn't that imply that prices are falling roughly 1%? Yes, it does. But at the same time, what is the additional spending in gold doing to the relationship between the gold sales revenues and the gold costs? It's widened the difference because there's more gold when you're making the sales than there was when you made the outlays that now constitute the cost. So under a gold standard, the increase in gold brings about some modest elevation of the rate of profit, even at the same time that prices might be falling because of more production. And I think that this is a very powerful point, arguing against calling the gold standard and the falling prices that occur because of increased production. It's a powerful argument against thinking of that as deflation in any sense. Falling prices caused by more production, you could already see, are not deflation. And at the same time, under a gold standard, there's a positive elevation in the rate of profit. All right, well, we need to go beyond the monetary component. I think what I've done up to now is I've acknowledged the significance of an increase in the quantity of money. The increase in the quantity of money is a significant factor in the determination of the money rate of profit. But it's a factor that has hitherto been almost entirely ignored. Now, we don't want to go overboard with it. We need to acknowledge its existence, recognize it, and there is more to say about it. But it would be a very unsatisfactory state of affairs if the whole explanation of profit interest were just the increase in the quantity of money. And we need to look for other determinants. Well, how can we proceed to find other determinants of profit interest apart from the role of the increase in money and spending, which we acknowledge and now put aside? Well, the way we can do this is we must now assume that there is no increase in the quantity of money. We are going to have a fixed quantity of money supporting a fixed total volume of spending. And this is what I mean by invariable money. Invariable money is a fixed quantity of money in the economic system resulting in a fixed total volume of spending to buy newly produced goods. And that's are going to be our next step, to find determinants of profit under the assumption of an invariable money. Now, as soon as we make this assumption, a very major problem may appear to arise, which calls into question the very possibility of the existence of an excess of sales proceeds over cost of production in the economic system as a whole. The problem arises because of the following considerations. Taken in the aggregate, business firms are the source of their own sales revenues. The sales revenues of all the firms taken together are coming from all the firms taken together. Outlays for capital goods are sales revenues to the sellers of capital goods. For example, when General Motors purchases steel sheet, that's a purchase of capital goods for General Motors, and it's simultaneously, by the same stroke, sales revenues to U.S. Steel. Wage payments are the principal source of sales revenues to the sellers of consumers' goods. For example, the wages paid by General Motors and U.S. Steel are the source of sales revenues to grocers and other sellers of consumers' goods. So we've got business in making its outlays for means of production generating sales revenues equivalent to those outlays. Well, the problem that arises is that looking at it that way, costs must seemingly equal sales revenues. Outlays for capital goods and labor, the source of equivalent sales revenues, also result in costs of production equal to those outlays. If the aggregate outlays for means of production were the same year after year for assets of the same life, annual costs of production in the economic system would tend to equal those outlays. And this seems to imply that if expenditures for means of production were the only source of business sales revenues and costs being equal to the same thing, the outlay for means of production, would be equal to each other, and thus that no aggregate profit interest would exist. Well, happily, there is, we'll see one way out of that, and I refer to indefinite postponement of the elimination of profit interest. What makes possible this postponement? Well, the equalization of profit interest of costs and expenditure for means of production, they're not exactly the same. They're closely connected. Outlays for means of production will show up as costs, but that doesn't mean they are instantaneously costs. The costs that we have derive from outlays for means of production, but for the most part from outlays for means of production in the past. There is an important element of time lag. And the way I put it is the equalization of expenditure for means of production and costs can be indefinitely postponed so long as what we Austrians call a lengthening of the period of production can take place. And I'll give you some simple illustrations. Imagine that the same sum of money was annually spent in the purchase of equipment with a 3-year life. Now, when a firm buys a piece of, let's say, a computer would typically be depreciated over 3 years. If a firm buys $1 million worth of new computers, that outlay does not show up as $1 million of cost in the year in which they purchase the computers. If they bought them in the first quarter and the computers are depreciated over 3 years, the depreciation cost would be $1 million. They've spent one-third of a million. They've spent $1 million to buy the computers, but the computers last 3 years, only one-third the depreciation is charged as cost. But what happens if they spend a second $1 million next year buying a second batch of computers? Then what's the depreciation on the two batches? Well, it'll be a third of $2 million. It'll be, and after a third year, they have three batches. At the end of 3 years, there'll be $1 million of cost corresponding to the $1 million of outlay. So here it would only take 3 years. But what would happen to the extent that expenditure for equipment shifted from equipment with a 3-year life to equipment with a 10-year life or a 20-year life? Do you see that it takes longer for the costs to catch up with the outlays? But if you're buying equipment with an average life of 10 years, it's going to take 10 years for depreciation costs to catch up. If you're constructing longer-lived assets, it takes still longer. And there are many other examples I could give, but we don't have much time. In connection with such things as buildings, inventories, construction projects, the basic principle is that a lengthening of the period of production entails a deferral of costs further into the future. The costs are not the same thing as the outlays for the means of production. We have outlays for means of production, but the corresponding costs, to a great degree, are deferred into the future, and they can be further deferred depending on the length of the period of production. Now I have a further reference, postponement of the elimination of profit interest, net investment. So long as the expenditure for the means of production exceeds cost of production, sales revenues equal to the expenditure for the means of production exceed those same costs, and aggregate profit interest exists. So you've established you can have expenditure for means of production, but the costs do not immediately equal that expenditure. You'd have to repeat that expenditure for assets of the same life year after year for quite a few years before costs would catch up. And as long as the period of production can be lengthened, costs will not yet catch up. So we have expenditure for means of production generating sales revenues equal to itself, but the expenditure for means of production can be greater than costs, and to the same extent, sales revenues will be greater than costs. So in this interval, we have aggregate profit interest. And this aggregate profit interest, you should realize, constitutes net investment. Why net investment? Well, this is because the expenditure for means of production, such as plant and equipment, inventory and work in progress, these expenditures add to the value of firm's asset accounts, while the corresponding elements of cost subtract from those asset accounts. When a firm buys an inventory, let's say, of sofas, a furniture store is selling sofas, and they take a shipment from a sofa factory. The sofas go into their warehouse. The expenditure is added to their inventory account. As and when they sell the sofas and the sofas come out of the warehouse, then and only then are they racking up costs, and it appears as cost of goods sold. So long as they spend more adding to inventory than they have cost of goods sold, well, they have a net investment in inventory. And similarly with plant and equipment expenditures. Well, for elaboration, I'd have to refer you to my book, but it follows from this discussion that in the conditions of an invariable money with no source of business sales revenues but expenditure for means of production, profit interest would exist equal to net investment. And in fact, that's one of the major propositions of my theory, that net investment is a major determinant of profit interest. Now, one of the things I develop in the book is that if we drop the assumption of an invariable money, the increase in the quantity of money is going to be mainly reflected in net investment. It's going to operate to enlarge net investment. All right, but there would be a problem still if the only source of profits were the lengthening of the period of production. If the only source of an aggregate profit was net investment, we'd have a problem, and that is there would then be an inexorable tendency toward a declining rate of profit, and you can see why. This is because whatever net investment occurs adds to accumulated capital, which implies that next year net investment must be proportionately larger if the rate of profit is not to fall. For example, imagine we started out, we had 1,000 of invested capital, and in that year there was 100 of net investment. Well, what rate of profit would be implied if net investment equals profit? We'd have 100 of profit on 1,000 of capital, we'd have 10%. But that 100 of net investment is added to capital, we now have 1,100 of capital. How much net investment would we need the next year in order to maintain a 10% rate of profit? 10% of 1,100, 110. So we need 110 of net investment. Then we have 1,210 of capital. Then we need 121 of net investment. But in an invariable money, how could this be happening? The expenditure for means of production would be unchanged. We'd be talking about costs having to decline at an accelerating rate. They'd have to get to zero and into negative territory. Well, that's utterly impossible. So net investment certainly cannot accelerate. And in fact, any net investment whatever implies a lengthening of the period of production. For example, an unchanged annual expenditure to construct buildings with a depreciable life of 40 years results in equivalent annual depreciation charges at the end of 40 years. Costs are continually tending to catch up with expenditure for the means of production of any given life. So you'd have to be continually finding means of production of longer and longer life. Well, fortunately, there's another cause of aggregate profit interest that can be identified under an invariable money, and that does not imply any fall in the rate of profit interest, and that's operative alongside of net investment, and if and when net investment becomes zero. And that is what I call net consumption. And it's the most important aspect of my theory of profit interest. In an economy with an invariable money, it would ultimately be the sole source and determinant of aggregate profit interest. And as I will explain, I regard it as the link that connects time preference to the rate of profit interest, the actual link. Well, to understand net consumption, we need to realize that in addition to the expenditures for capital goods and labor, there is a further source of business sales revenues. The expenditure for means of production by business is not the sole exclusive source of business sales revenues. There is a further source, and that is the consumption expenditure of businessmen and capitalists themselves. Their consumption expenditure constitutes sales revenues to the sellers of consumers' goods, but does not have any counterpart in the costs of business firms. It's financed by such means as dividend payments to stockholders and by draw payments to partners and sole proprietors. I call this consumption net consumption. It's consumption that takes place in excess of wage payments. It's consumption net of wage payments. Now, in an economy with an invariable money, net consumption brings about the existence of profit interest in a way that is similar to net investment, namely by reducing the costs that business firms deduct from their unchanged aggregate sales revenues. Remember, in an invariable money, we have the same quantity of money, the same total sales revenues. So that's going to continue. Net investment reduces the cost deducted from sales revenues by means of deferring the costs. Net investment reduces these costs by deferring them to the future. The longer the period of production, the further into the future do the costs show up. Now, net consumption reduces the cost deducted from sales revenues by reducing the expenditure for the means of production, and thus the point toward which the costs are tending. Just keep in mind, suppose we have expenditure for means of production of some definite amount for assets of any definite life. Imagine we have expenditure to construct buildings with a 40-year life. But this expenditure is repeated year after year after year. Well, what's happening to annual depreciation cost? It will equal the annual expenditure. It'll take 40 years, but it'll equal it. The costs are tending to equal the expenditure for the means of production unless the expenditure for the means of production go further out into the future. If the expenditure for the means of production stabilizes for assets of any given life, then what's happening to costs sooner or later? They'll catch up to it. But what will happen if the expenditure for the means of production is reduced below sales revenues? Why is it reduced below sales revenues? Because businessmen and capitalists are consuming some funds that they had previously been expending for means of production. And once you have expenditure for means of production below sales revenues, well, costs can equal those expenditures for means of production, and what do we have? We have an aggregate profit. The costs are equaling an expenditure for means of production, which is less than the sales revenues. To the extent that the sales revenues exceed the expenditure for means of production, It doesn't matter if costs equal the expenditure for means of production. The sales revenue is greater than that expenditure will be equally greater than the costs. Now, I'll just say a little bit further on net consumption. Net consumption, I believe, has existed since the origin of money and was, in fact, larger relative to total expenditure for the products of business in the past than it is today. This is because the consumption expenditure of self-employed workers and farmers is a consumption expenditure of businessmen and capitalists, not wage earners. The activity of these groups relative to the economic system as a whole was larger in the past than it is today. Nevertheless, for illustrative purposes, we can imagine net consumption coming into being simply on the foundation of the capital that's been accumulated on the foundation of net investment. So years of net investment. We've explained how net investment achieves profit. So let's assume this has gone on for some time. And now here we are. There are numerous businessmen and capitalists who are now quite wealthy. They've accumulated enough capital so that they could live for many years simply off of their accumulated capital. How much will they judge they can afford to consume depends on their time horizons. A capitalist whose time horizon extends 50 years into the future will judge that he can afford to consume 2% of his accumulated capital each year and have enough to maintain his standard of living for 50 years. Another capitalist whose time horizon extends 25 years into the future will judge that he can afford to consume 4% of his accumulated capital each year and have enough for 25 years. Of course, I'm depicting a degree of regularity and arithmetical precision which will probably not be found often in real life, so please take it as a rough approximation. Let's assume overall, for the sake of illustration, that if we take all the capitalists together, the overall average rate of net consumption turns out to be 3% a year. In other words, they have these accumulated capitals. They believe they can afford, on an overall average, to consume an amount equal to 3% of their accumulated capital. Well, understood in this way, the average rate of net consumption prevailing in the economic system clearly reflects a form of time preference. Those whose time horizon extends to 25 years have a higher time preference than those whose time horizon extends to 50 years, and so on until we reach those whose time horizon extends to no further than the next day or week. Well, net consumption operates on the rate of profit interest by reducing the expenditure for means of production. Some of the funds that up to now have been expended for capital goods and the payment of wages are used instead to pay dividends, or are simply withdrawn from firms by the partners or sole proprietors who own them for the purpose of buying consumers' goods. They want to live and enjoy life too. Well, please note, the expenditure to buy capital goods is less, the expenditure to pay wages is less, so too as a result is the consumption expenditure of the wage earners. In the place of the expenditure for capital goods and the expenditure for consumers' goods by wage earners, there's now an expenditure for consumers' goods by businessmen and capitalists. The overall total expenditure for goods as such remains unchanged. We still have an invariable money. What's different now is that because the demand for means of production is less, it is only a question of time before costs too will be less. Costs will tend to equal the now lower expenditure for means of production. When they do, profit interest in the economic system equal to net consumption has come into existence. And this is because sales revenues in the economic system exceed the expenditure for means of production by the amount of net consumption and equivalently exceed costs equal to the expenditure for means of production. The sales revenues exceed the expenditure for means of production, and if the costs equal the expenditure for means of production, the sales revenues exceed them. Well, whatever the overall rate of net consumption relative to accumulated capital, that's what the rate of profit interest will tend to equal, because an amount of profit interest equal to net consumption will have been generated. And in an economy with an invariable money, this rate of net consumption will serve as a barrier to further net investment. Any net investment that's made will have to be sufficiently worthwhile to overcome this. Now, one last important word on this. I have to stress as strongly as possible that what determines the rate of profit interest is the system-wide average rate of net consumption. No individual businessman or capitalist is able to improve his own rate of profit by consuming more. To the contrary, he'll reduce the profit interest he earns because he will deplete his capital, which is his means of earning profit interest, to a far greater degree than he can possibly add to profits in the economic system. The profit interest he will contribute to by virtue of his own consumption is the profit interest earned by others, not him. Imagine, for example, Bill Gates reads the Rubaiyat by Omar Khayyam. He decides he wants to consume his $43 billion of capital. Well, this would tend to add to the economy-wide average rate of profit, but it would not help Bill Gates at all. He would have no means of earning any profit. It would raise the profits of other businessmen and capitalists. Okay, well, much, much more needs to be said in support of the net consumption, net investment theory. I've merely given you a brief overview. For the necessary elaboration and answers to many or most of the questions you may have concerning it, I can only hope you'll read my book, Capitalism, A Treatise on Economics. I had planned to just run by a list of further implications. Capital accumulation does not require or cause a falling rate of profit interest. The relationship of saving to capital accumulation is as force to acceleration, not force to motion. There are all kinds of things. I'll skip to the very last two. An overthrow of the Marxian exploitation theory. Profits are not a deduction from wages, but wages and other costs are a deduction from sales revenues, which in the absence of capitalists and their expenditures for means of production would be all profit. Finally, overthrow of the Keynesian unemployment equilibrium doctrine, the IS curve and MEC curve. According to the Keynesians, we tend to get locked into an unemployment equilibrium. They think we need more net investment. The effect of the additional net investment is to reduce the rate of profit interest below the minimum acceptable rate. The reality is that profits and net investment, as I indicated, are very closely connected. And if one retained the IS curve, MEC curve, you would need to reverse their slope. In the context of recovery from a depression, profits will rise virtually dollar for dollar with the recovery of net investment. You need to know a little bit about Keynesian economics to appreciate this, but as some of you do. And there's an awful lot of radical 180-degree turns that follow from working out an analysis based on the assumption of invariable money. I know it's too much to digest. It's like I'm stuffing corn down the gullet of a goose or something. But hopefully, if a few kernels here and there have seemed of interest, you'll study this material further. I thank you very, very much for having come and spent another hour of your time.